Beyond the issues of international cooperation, no strategy aimed at fostering the emergence of a sustainable development path would be complete without a fundamental rethinking of the human values that have driven much of the development process during the past century. A considerable body of academic research in recent years has examined the issue of the correlation between growing income and human happiness. The question itself might have appeared slightly quaint a couple of decades ago, when economists in academia and policymakers in government and international financial organizations more or less accepted as an article of faith that higher growth and income would always be desirable and would increase human welfare, and along with it, presumably happiness. Several insights, however, have contributed to a gradual change of perspective. First, the realization that however beneficial might have been the several decades of robust post-economic growth in improving living standards, the global economy was beginning to run up against environmental constraints, which could actually be measured. Second, psychologists, newly empowered with analytical tools developed in other sciences, were able to show that human happiness was correlated with income only up to a certain level. Money seemed to be crucially important for happiness when basic material needs had not yet been met. But once these had been satisfied, the sources of happiness shifted to other concerns, reflecting deeper spiritual aspirations, including friendship, love, relationships, a sense of purpose in life, security, among others. The level of income at which the correlation with happiness disappears has been estimated at around $10,000 to $13,000, using $1,995 and adjusting for differences in purchasing power across countries. Nobel laureate Amartya Sen suggests that societies operate better on some presumption of trust. Here we refer to the need for openness, the freedom to deal with one another under guarantees of disclosure and lucidity, as he puts it. This is tremendously important for preventing corruption and other abuses. Experience has shown that where there is trust, citizens and businesses pay their taxes. This in turn enables the government to formulate policies to achieve various social ends because the resources are available to invest in these areas. As societies see the fruits of these efforts, trust in the government is reinforced and the country enters into what one can call a virtuous cycle of development. Of course, vicious circles are also possible, of which the past half century offers far too many disappointing examples. 20 years ago, there was very little debate about the role of corruption in the development process. It was certainly a taboo subject in the corridors of the IMF and the World Bank, where there was a tendency to separate technical judgments about the intricacies of macroeconomic policy from value judgments about the domestic political dimension. Fortunately, there is now broad understanding that openness and transparency are key drivers of prosperity, although there is no need to frame the debate in moral, ethical, or religious terms. It is enough to see it as an economic efficiency issue. Where corruption is rampant, for instance, companies and individuals see paying taxes as a bad business proposition. In contrast, as I noted earlier, in the Nordic countries, with the lowest levels of corruption in the world and the highest tax burdens, everybody pays taxes because the benefits of doing so are immediately visible. Excellent infrastructure, a highly trained labor force, an extensive social safety net, excellent education, and so on. Some of us would argue that the above observations suggest the need to broaden the definition of what constitutes well-being and investigate more closely the relationship between increasing market activity and the welfare of the people participating in the economic system. One starting point would be to establish a clear mental demarcation between the concepts of growth on the one hand and development on the other. The first, growth, is essentially a quantitative concept which captures the expansion in the scale of the economic system. Well, the latter refers to qualitative changes in the system and in its relationship with the environment and other aspects of life in the community. Properly understood, economics should concern itself less with how to add to the physical dimension of the economic system and more with the long-term welfare of the community whose interests the system is ultimately intended to serve. This distinction is quite fundamental. For instance, Herman Daly and John Cobb, in a very influential book they wrote in the mid-90s, argued that the global ecosystem will change in coming decades because it will be physically forced to change, they say. To give a sense of the scope of additional expansion of the global economy, they observe that in the early 1990s, human beings were appropriating some 40% of the total terrestrial production of photosynthesis. An additional doubling of the human scale would leave very little energy left for all non-human species, since, they say, humans cannot survive without the services of ecosystems which are made up of other species, unquote. It becomes clear that another doubling of the human scale would put unbearable pressure on the Earth's ecosystem, if not actually become an ecological impossibility. The doubling time of human population at the moment is about 40 years. However, as currently formulated, the aim of development policy is to increase the average per capita consumption of global resources, thus reducing, in the absence of some major technological breakthrough, the length of time needed to double the scale of the global economy and its claim on world resources. They conclude that, I quote, "Unless we awaken to the existence and nearness of scale limits, then the greenhouse effect, ozone layer depletion, and acid rain will be just a preview of disasters to come, not in the vague distant future, but in the next generation." Unquote. The deep interconnections between care for the environment and spirituality has been the subject of increasing exploration. James Gustav Speth, Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University, believes that the economy to be an inherently rapacious and ruthless system, as he says, and that, I quote, "It is up to citizens to inject values that reflect human aspirations rather than just making money," unquote. Al Gore dedicates an entire chapter in his extraordinarily prescient book, Earth in the Balance, to the role of spirituality in the case of environmentalism, and had this to say about the Baha'i view. I quote, "Perhaps because his guiding visions were formed during the period of accelerating industrialism, Baha'i seems to dwell on the spiritual implications of the great transformation to which it bore fresh witness." And then he quotes from the Baha'i writings, we cannot segregate the human heart from the environment outside us and say that one of these is reformed, and that once one of these is reformed, everything will be improved. Man is organic with the world. His inner life molds the environment and is itself deeply affected by it. Then one acts upon the other, and every abiding change in the life of man is the result of these mutual reactions." Unquote. The challenges posed by the above are further elucidated in a document entitled The Prosperity of Humankind, a statement issued by the Baha'i International Community some 10 years ago, in which they say a culture which attaches absolute value to expansion, to acquisition, and to the satisfaction of people's wants is being compelled to recognize that such goals are not by themselves realistic guides to policy. As the experience of recent decades has demonstrated, material benefits and endeavors cannot be regarded as ends in themselves. Their value consists not only in providing for humanity's basic needs in housing, food, healthcare, and the like, but in extending the reach of human abilities. The most important role that economics must play in development lies, therefore, in equipping people and institutions with the means through which they can achieve the real purpose of development, that is, laying foundations for a new social order that can cultivate the limitless potentialities latent in human consciousness." Unquote.